has the first question. Liz. Liz, Jack has the microphone here, Liz.
Chris, good to see you again. I went to a meeting last week in my hometown that I'd never been to. It was called the God Step meeting. They announced at the beginning that they only discuss the steps that deal directly with God. So my question is, what steps don't deal directly with God?
They all certainly point toward God. Maybe they're talking about the ones with God actually written in them, but certainly the whole process of the steps is an arrow right to a personal relationship with God. So I don't know that you could really leave any of the steps out, you know. How about another question? Tom
Platt, alcoholic. The you know, we talked about, Peter, you talked about earlier the you know, we get the power back. I'm looking for specific references in the book that show me where we get the power back that I can show to people.
The first place I'm thinking of is page 68. We let God demonstrate through us what he can do. The first place I experienced that. Is this on? But the best explanation is for them to have their own experience with this power. And then the words, even in the book, fall short. They're just pointers.
Okay, how about another one? Just walk right back to the mic.
David Alcoholic.
David, hey.
I'm always confused by this, and you were talking a little bit about it, Peter, but with the third step. So you go through this third step, and then after it goes, you know, we thought well before taking this step. And then, you know, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person. This is all after the third step happens. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned your variation on it, which is, you know, making it your own and putting in your own phraseology. Mm-hmm. And just wondering, just more from a mechanical standpoint, how do you achieve this? And I always just find it a little perplexing that, you know, it has a step in there and then it says, well, think well about this, this thing you just did. Wondering what's your take on all that in sort of a sequential way.
Okay. Why that's put in there afterwards, I don't know why. And maybe Chris could help me with that one. As far as mechanics go, the considerations from 62 to 63 are, if you will, a new design for living and the promises that I'm going to experience less and less of me, more and more of others, and about losing fear of today, tomorrow, hereafter. I get reborn. Doctor's opinion talks about recreating our life. And I was to take those considerations and offer them up, and am I willing to live along those considerations? Step three. And my third step prayer was an affirmation of that. I'm willing to turn this all over to God. And I just kind of sealed the deal with the third step prayer. What's significant about doing the third step prayer for me in my experience was it was the methodology to step into step four. I'm going to convey this to God with another person, a third step prayer, that I'm going to turn my will and life over to this power, and I carry that out by 4 through 9. Okay.
You know, what I could share on that is the statement, we thought well before taking this step. If you'll look in the chapter Working with Others, it basically tells you that with your new prospect, you're to leave the book with them and ask them to read it, and then you're to come back and start working the steps. If that's the way they did it, a lot of times they just moved you through really quickly. But if you've had an opportunity to read the book, I like to have the people that ask me to sponsor them. I like to ask them to read the book and to consider, you know, is there anything in here you're going to be unwilling to do? Because when you ask somebody to go to any lengths, you want them to know what that looks like. And also, I think that they say, we thought well before making this decision. You're making a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. There may be no turning back. And I've seen people who've gotten started on that process and then stopped or changed their mind or gone backwards. And there's a fallout that happens once you've made a decision and then you go back the other direction. So it might be a little warning in there, too, that you're about to enter into something monumental. Anybody else?
Yeah. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Marty. And Chris, I have a question more about my own belief in being safe and protected, in that I don't think that there's a point in time when you're doing the work, you're on the record in the right groove. And in my belief is that you are safe and protected. You didn't do step 10 yet. And if just what you had said, where if you back out of your writing, if you've held something back, if you don't do your amends, you're never going to be safe and protected. But my belief is that you are safe and protected. At some point, you're doing the work, you're trying your best, and by God does not seek, but God does not make it too hard on those who try to seek him, or excuse me. But anyway, so my thought is you are safe and protected. I just want your thought on that. Like, that's my belief.
Yeah, there's a grace that'll happen if you're in the middle of the work. The problem is a lot of times people will balk in the middle of the work. They'll set their step work aside for a month or two because they get busy, and you know you can pay for that. You can pay for that by drinking. But I think that we get granted that sobriety prior to recovery. I think we get granted that by our willingness and our participation. And if we're doing what we can do, you know, we will stay sober while we're going through the work, if we're doing everything that we can do. But again, there are people who are in the middle of the step process who've been in step 4 for a year and a half, or they're in 6 and 7 because they don't want to go into 8 and 9. And, you know, you can really be asking for trouble if you're doing that.
Yeah, hi. It has to do with working with others, that if you're working with somebody and they just have the reservation that they're just there for a drinking problem, that the real problem doesn't rest in the mind, then how do you prod them? You know, if they're not willing to even see the unmanageability of step 1, how do you prod them onto the further steps and getting connected to that higher power?
That's a great question.
You can't. The depth of my willingness is manifested in my actions. I can present the consequences. I can give them little spiritual homework assignments. Give me 5 reasons why you want me as a sponsor. Give me 5 reasons why you want to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Give me a list 5 things that's going to happen to you without a spiritual experience. May work. Maybe have them get in touch with, you're about to drop them or something. Well, they're really, in reality, what happens is I never fired anyone. They fired me because they didn't want what I have to offer anymore. But you can do all of that. But the willingness, really, for me, came out of circumstances being so horrific that moved me to be open, and I stopped praying for that prayer of willingness. I've heard people say, bring a horse to water, can't make him drink, and there's some truth to that. You know, my trouble spots early sponsoring was I wanted it more for them than they did. And so what I would do is I would water it down. All right, just do this. You know, don't worry about that. And I was getting sick off of that, because I had someone else reading my big book for me, right? And if I didn't do that, I would just jam it at them. You know, this way or the highway because I know what's good for you. And I was getting sick off of that. Then you get the prospect who shows up, whatever the bottom is, Park Avenue, Park Bench, they bottomed out not only physically but the emotional bottom. And you say, can you go home and read the book? And they come back 3 days later, I did it. What do you want me to do next? Okay, we're going to create, we're going to go to the, you know, we're going to write our fourth step. You're going to need to create a first column. Call you up a couple of days later, what do I do next? Yeah. Spending lots of time, by the way, and I, at the risk of sounding cold or callous, because we always stand at the door. Even when they fire us and they don't want, we have to offer, or God forbid they're out on another drunk, which perhaps can be a good thing if they bottom out and come back. We stand at the door and we wait. But I give assignments out. I was going somewhere with this. We give assignments out to folks. And the ones who bottom out follow directions. The ones who haven't bottomed out won't follow directions. I give it away the way I, that's where I was going. I give it away the way I give it away now. And some will come and some won't. So you'll spend a whole lot of time on this person. You want to give it to them. You want it for them. You have a feeling of for them. There's something close. There's a closeness going on. And you always get those prospects every once in a while. They show up and you just, they're like the long lost brother or sister, you know, and you just want to help them. And you give it and you give it and you give it and they don't respond. When I do that, the other ones who's banging on a door for my help, I can't hear. And so I need to just move on. And perhaps the consequences of that, of their behavior this time, will, maybe will raise the bottom for them. Page 96 talks about that. So that's a really long answer to you can't.
That's great. Yeah. How about somebody else?
Something we said.
I'm Ann. I'm an alcoholic.
Ann.
When you're working with a prospect who's very willing to do all of the work, but you feel like there's a reservation in the second part of that first step, you know, they know that they're alcoholic and they know that they're powerless, but, and they're saying, you know, they've got step one, step two, step three, and are more than willing to go forward with the rest of the steps, but you feel like there's a piece hanging there. And that second part, you know, where a lot of their life is still manageable. You know, maybe they're not losing their home or their car or their family. How do you impress upon them the unmanageability of that second part of the first step when it doesn't look that way on a physical plane?
One of the most difficult things that presents itself to us trying to carry the message to the other alcoholic is to help them understand that they're in more trouble than they think they are. Sometimes you can help with that, sometimes you can't. I've really tried to work on how I explain my own personal experience with the first number of steps. I really tried to get very, very good at expressing the unmanageability, my spiritual unmanageability. And I tried to get very, very good at using experiences to show the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. And, you know, some people you're going to be more successful with that than others. Most of the times, though, if they remain unconvinced of the first step, they'll stop somewhere in the process or give it half measures somewhere in the process, but, you know, not always. So, you know, it's very, 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 very difficult to know what to do in a situation like that, except share your own experience and hopefully get some identification going. But some of these people just are not able to comprehend, you know, how bad things are, you know, and we can only do what we can do. But you gain experience as you do more and more 12-step work. And sometimes you gain experience that'll help, and sometimes you're just not going to get through. The rehabs are filled with people who don't even know they're in trouble. You know what I mean? So it's a tough job.
Hi, family. Paul DeLeo, recovered alcoholic. I have a question. Peter, on page 92, it says, if you are satisfied, he's a real alcoholic. How do you treat someone if you're not satisfied? I've got a few guys I work with. I'm not sure that they're real alcoholics. How do you deal with that?
I've had that experience with a few folks. And, I mean, one guy, I sat with him, been in AA for a long time. And he says, can you sponsor me? He gave me spiritual consent, and off we went. And sat down and looking at some first step considerations. I even had him write something out for me. And I'll call him Joe. I said, Joe, did you ever pick up a drink? Give me one beer in your story. I'll be happy. Give me a beer. Yeah. It was all behavioral stuff. You know, and I was not satisfied he was a real alcoholic. I wasn't even satisfied he was a moderate drinker. I would have settled even for that, right? Not even a drug addict. Nothing.
A nut.
Are you bored? Are you hanging around us? You know. And I share with him, I how can I work with you? You know, it was becoming draining work. There was drama, nothing but drama. Anyway, I sought counsel with a few folks, and they says, I tried work with him too. He's not an alcoholic. I directed him to therapy. I directed him back to his religious community, directed him to some professionals. You know, come to our open meetings. So I had a few men come to me like that. And the first one that came my way, I felt really like disloyal to Alcoholics Anonymous, like I was doing something awful, like God was going to really get me this time for doing that. But, you know, it didn't, no sweat off their back when I said, I can't work with you. It was just moved on to someone else, which kind of was a red flag of their condition anyway. So I even tried to work with men who were claimed to be addicted to crack cocaine. No success with that. The identification was the big problem, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's direct them to perhaps someone else outside of AA. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Darren, I'm an alcoholic.
Darren.
You guys have both spoken quite a bit about the dilution of the message in AA, contemporary AA, and the need to kind of bring people back to the book and the steps the way it was envisioned by the founders. And I live in Manhattan, and I definitely have experienced that. I'm wondering... I struggle with ego when I sort of talk to people about that in meetings. And I'm wondering what the best way to carry that message is. Is it to kind of be the voice crying in the wilderness at these meetings? Or is it to found your own meeting and try to attract people? Just love to hear you both talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I've had experience both ways. I was the obnoxious voice crying in the wilderness for a period of time. Some people would agree with that. And I'm not saying that was bad completely, because there were people that responded to that in the meetings. Probably the majority of the people in the meetings didn't. But I've also been involved, as has Peter, in developing the fellowship we crave. And that's a much more comfortable environment. But... you know, ultimately, I just want to talk a minute about the unity and where I would like to see the unity of the fellowship. For a long time, there was very little literature-based recovery action going on in the North Jersey area, and from what I hear, New York and Connecticut and some other places. And all of a sudden, you know, the Joe and Charlie tapes came out, the Joe and Mark tapes came out, and there was some interest in it, and it started to blossom a little bit, this renewed enthusiasm and motivation toward working a recovery process from the book. and little areas have popped up, little pockets of enthusiasm that we can all go and kind of get recharged at. But the fact of the matter is if you follow the book, what the book is telling us is to carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic. Now, what I would like to see in the unity and what we're starting to see a little bit in some places in North Jersey is that every meeting have literature-based guys in it. And if there's, you know, if there's some heavy drinkers or type twos or whatever that, you know, aren't hardcore with the big book, that's fine. But at least if you walk into a meeting, there'll be somebody in there to recognize that you're a real alcoholic and to stick out their hand. Make sure that the hand of AA gets stuck out and it's not full of crap. You know what I mean? So I'm really hoping for that type of a unity to develop. But, you know, it was a good question. And just participate. You know, ask God for the guidance to what direction you need to participate in this. And then follow that guidance. What do you got here?
Challenge the contemporary stuff, challenge, you know, things that based on your experience never worked. But I think the test for myself is when I'm coming at someone with an attitude of I'm right and you're wrong, so I can get a reputation, so I can prove me right, so I can show others I'm some sort of guru, then I know it's all about me. See, if you know, I'm in a middle of the road meeting and I have 20 people who are putting a plug in a jug and don't drink, go to meeting, and meeting makers make it, I can challenge that based on my experience as a real alcoholic. I got loaded on that information. I would wind up homeless on that information, you know, in the back of some alleyway. So I, based on my experience, I like to challenge that. First, where is it in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, put the plug in a jug? Nowhere. Because then Chris and I would have to take a hat and go home, right? Meeting makers make it appears nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yet this is the information that gets us recovered. So I've done that, and I've been on this side of the fence, and I'm here to share this. And you can challenge that stuff as passionately as you want. But when I'm coming at it, I'm right, look at me, you're wrong, look at you, then I do a disservice to everyone. I become a horror of example rather than a power of example. And I have some dear friends of mine who get to this podium and be as passionate as you could imagine, but will help anyone, whoever it may be.
Got time for one more?
Hi, I was wondering when it comes to letting go of character defects and transforming them, in addition to prayer, do you have any suggestions, like besides act as if?
Yeah, get out of the way and let God do what he has to do.
Absolutely.
Seriously. God will do. See, we kind of suit up and show up to this work and trust the work. In fact, when we're into amends and we're being accountable and responsible for harms caused to others, and we're showing up and knocking on doors that we have to do with amends, we will see how those defects start to dissolve very quickly and the transformation happens. That's why it says, as we clean up the past, it says, this thought brings us to step 10. We've entered the world of the spirit. The past is now being put to sleep. So trust the work and God will do that for us. I can't will myself into having no character defects or can't will myself into a spiritual experience, but God could and would if he was sought. Yeah.
It took me so long to recognize the fact that I can't aim right toward my character defects directly. I have to work around the side. I have to participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I've got to ask God for the power and direction to go through the steps. And by doing those things, the character defects can be removed. My first run, my first bastardized run through the steps, I hung out in steps 6 and 7 working on my character defects. Have you ever seen that game, Whack-A-Mole? You know, where you take the mallet and you hit the mole and then another one pops up and then you hit that mole and another one pops up. Well, that's what it was like. I was trying not to be selfish. I was trying not to be stupid. I was trying not to do this. I was trying to, I was whacking the mole. You know what I mean? You know what happens when you whack the mole too much? You can go blind. So be careful with that. We got to bring Doug up.
Before we on that wonderful spiritual note, before we bring Doug up, I just want to make a quick announcement that there's two gentlemen in the back here, Danny, who in March makes 26 years, and Vinny, who's next to him, makes 25 years.
All right. The same about, so. Jack.
Do you think it's... Huh? Oh, here you go. Do you think it's possible that AA could be considered like a cult type thing? You know? Don't mean to offend anybody.
Some people have accused us of that. You know, it would depend on how you would define a cult. What paradigm would you use for the definition of a cult?
I don't know. I just see all these triangles and things. And
I think most cults really want your money. And, you know, we're okay without your money. So I don't know.
We're building a fire at midnight. There's actually, if you go online, and I'm in a treatment center business, and I visit lots of places, and I get some of my information. And there's a couple of treatment centers that say AA does not work. And if you click on some of their links and some of these little articles that have come out, we're considered by some a cult. But we don't harm here. What we do is get people to experience God. We're different than a religious community. So that's an outside issue. For your own well-being, consider that an outside issue which you don't need to be involved with. See, our house is clean. Move on. Yeah.
Okay, hey, Doug, come on up.